You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lano Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy to welcome Ed Williams. He's an investigative reporter with Searchlight New Mexico. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So you recently wrote two articles on what's happening in our schools in New Mexico to kids and to parents. One of them was called Criminalizing Disability, and the other was about retaliation against parents who advocate for their children. Let's start with the first story. It's about a young man named Sebastian Montano, who my heart went out to this young person as I read your work. He's a teenager of high intelligence. He also has multiple mental health issues, including autism, bipolar disorder, epilepsy, and PTSD. I mean, a kid with a lot of challenges. And instead of getting his special education services from the school system, the schools are continually calling the police on him. Tell us this story and how you came across it.
Right. I came across this story from some friends in the legal community who had heard about this just through advocacy work, and not just because it was an outlier, because it wasn't an outlier. It was actually representative of a much larger issue that goes on, not just in New Mexico, but across the country. And there are some districts here that seem to be even extreme in terms of a national context. But Sebastian is a kid who has had since birth, you know, multiple very serious disabilities. Like many students with disabilities, he was a brilliant student, but was never really given the services and special education that would have helped him draw on his intelligence for things like electronics, which he was just really good at. He could take apart and put together an iPhone or an Xbox. And there's an example his mom gave of one time she kind of turned her back and turned back around. He had disassembled her computer. He was, I think, 12 years old at this point, and kind of melded it with an Xbox. So he had created like a portable Xbox console so he could play his video games. That's the kind of student we would want to nurture and maybe one day have them work as an engineer at Los Alamos. But he also had a lot of behavior problems that were related to his disability. He would have outbursts. He would become aggressive if he was confronted by bullies. He had developed fears of school personnel because there was never any behavior intervention plans, is what they're called, is the process that you're supposed to follow to deal with a kid with disability-related behaviors. And instead, the schools would just discipline him. And this was a process that happened, you know, from elementary school all the way through high school until he eventually dropped out. He had, I think, 16 documented run-ins with police officers. And some of them were really extreme cases. I mean, they would learn at the middle school that he was talking to his classmates about killing himself. And instead of calling a mental health professional, they'd send in the police to talk to him. And of course, every interaction with police, some of them were violent. You know, sometimes they'd tackle him. His mom says he was tased, he was choked. We couldn't find any documentation of that, but, you know, his mother was, everything else she said checked out. And so we didn't include that in the story. But, you know, it exacerbates the situation. It complicates his fear of personnel. It makes him more aggressive, understandably. And so, you know, each of those interactions makes it more likely that you're going to have another one. And so that's what had happened to Sebastian. And he had ended up in jail instead of graduating high school. And the problem was that none of the schools, from elementary school all the way through high school, developed what's called a behavior intervention plan, or functional behavior analysis, which are two parts of the same process. Whenever you have a kid with a disability that has behavior problems that are related to that disability, you have to come up with a plan and a strategy to address the root causes of that behavior. And this is according to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is the federal law that regulates these things. The schools had never done that for years. And this was kind of the underlying failure of the system that led to him ending up in juvenile detention.
So the schools were in clear violation of the law, is that correct?
I think that's fair to say. Now, I mean, you know, any of the one cases, there were a lot of times when they should have, according to protocol. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not really prepared to make a legal determination here, give on any one instance.
Right.
But it is true. I am comfortable saying that, you know, when a student like this has these sort of disabilities and behaviors related to them, it is the law that the schools provide accommodations for those disabilities and not, you know, just pawn the students off to the local police department so that they don't have to deal with them.
One of the things that really struck me was that one of his symptoms is that he's easily overstimulated, so that being in a class with lots of other kids is really difficult. And he would do things like hit someone in order to get sent to detention where it's quiet. You'd think someone would figure that out.
Well, and it wasn't just they weren't figuring it out. His mother, who was extremely attentive and trying her best to help, was begging the schools to deal with these behaviors, to give him the services that he was eligible for under federal law and state law. So it's hard to wrap your head around why, for that period of time, the schools would not provide those accommodations. I mean, I think there's some, you know, he had kind of gotten labeled as a problem student, as a kid with a chip on his shoulder, as his mother described. And there was not there was a reluctance to recognize that these were disability related behaviors. I think the schools, especially the high school and the middle school in Alamogordo, just viewed this as, you know, this is a kid that's just a problem kid. At one point, they charged him with gang affiliation for bringing a Nerf gun to school. When you step back and look at the totality of the decisions that the school made, it is really pretty shocking that nowhere along the line did they do what they were supposed to do. And I should add that, you know, this wasn't universal. It's not like everyone that he came across with in the school system was not trying to help him. He had some teachers that were very good. The school psychologist, a guy named Ron Russell, he was doing his job very well and evaluating Sebastian throughout this whole process over a period of years, and finding that, you know, according to his medical evaluation, these were behaviors that were disability related and should be addressed by the school staff. He even took the step of forwarding an official request for an evaluation to the school administration, saying, you know, in so many words, look, you really need to develop a functional behavior analysis and a behavior intervention plan for this student, because otherwise he's going to just keep running into problems and not get any sort of education at all. And it looks like that fell on deaf ears.
Sebastian, as you said, dropped out of school, and then one day he was walking around town. He went to his old school and was arrested for trespassing, which I was thinking about that, like, it's not private property, so trespassing on a public school, I wondered about that. But in any case, there's a cell phone video of the arrest that I guess another student took. It's on the Searchlight New Mexico site by this article. And it's heartbreaking because you can hear how much this young person is suffering, how he's being traumatized by the cops. As he was flailing, one of his arms hit the officer, then he got charged with a felony. What happened next?
What happened next was, and he wasn't actually arrested for trespassing, he was approached for trespassing by the police, and instead of de-escalating the situation like they're supposed to according to their training, the school resource officer tried to arrest him. And of course, by this point, Sebastian had had so many traumatic interactions with police that it really freaked him out. And so, yeah, he kind of just screamed and had an episode and was pinned to the ground by that officer and another who was assisting that day at the school. And he suffered a seizure, according to the medical reports. That was the likely thing that happened because he couldn't remember anything that had occurred. So he woke up in the hospital unaware of what had happened and unaware of why he was being charged with these very serious crimes. His mother wasn't called or informed by the school. I think it was his sister or somebody else on campus who knew her, called her at work and told her to get over here. They're arresting Sebastian. So she rushed over and literally followed the ambulance to the hospital where he was being taken with the lights flashing, and at that point learned what had happened, and understandably was furious about this. The school resource officer, she said, knew that this child had these disabilities and should be treated a certain way. You know, they're not immune from the law. Having a disability doesn't mean you're immune from the law, but it does mean that according to best police practices and even training that Alamogordo Police Department has put into place, you should understand that there is a different situation here mentally, and you know, address the arrest accordingly if you do need to make an arrest. And I should add that the person who called the police on Sebastian that day was the school counselor who was on Sebastian's individualized education plan team, his special ed team, and was fully aware of all the issues that Sebastian had. He's the one that turned the police on Sebastian that day.
Was Sebastian doing anything, or was he walking around the grounds and that was it?
He was walking around the grounds. He had not done anything other than be on campus, according to the police reports. He said that he was looking for a missing person that he saw on TV. It doesn't really make sense as an explanation, but you know, this is a student with a lot of disabilities, so it might not have made sense why he was there. But his mother says he didn't even know that he wasn't supposed to be on campus. He didn't understand that there was a rule. I mean, that's where he had been for the last 2 or 3 years. So why can't I just go see my friends or walk on? You know, it just didn't occur to him, according to his mom, and according to him when I spoke to him. So no, he wasn't in the midst of committing any crimes other than, you know, only current students are allowed on campus. So if you have someone that's not enrolled, you're not supposed to be there. It doesn't really, in my opinion, and in the opinion of people I've spoken with, doesn't really merit calling the police. You know, there's no reason that counselor, this is what my sources in the legal community have said, couldn't have approached him himself and said, hey, you're not allowed to be on here. You should leave before you get in trouble.
This story bespeaks a combination of what looks to me like cruelty and stupidity and brutality and ignorance and all kinds of things. You have a situation, as you describe, where some school districts are tending to call the police on their students a lot, especially special education students. And I mean, some districts in New Mexico are really doing that. What's going on in those districts?
You know, that's a very good question. And we weren't able to, you know, obviously address every case that a police officer was called on a student with disabilities district-wide or statewide. From the teachers that I've spoken with, from the school personnel that I've spoken with, you know, just broadly, there are a lot of challenges that schools are facing. You know, individual teachers, people that are supposed to be dealing with this, really have their plates full. Writing a functional behavior analysis, which is that process to address the disability-related behavior, is extremely difficult, and teachers don't have a lot of support. Administration doesn't have a lot of support. We're asking a lot of schools, and I think we do need to recognize that. It is the law that schools provide those services, but I think there are bigger questions to ask in terms of why aren't those schools able to. I don't think in general it's fair to say that the schools are intentionally harming the kids. I think it's just that they're stretched so thin and that they don't have the supports that they need and the space they need to actually address these issues. I mean, we have a huge shortage of special education teachers statewide. I think that the most provisionally licensed teachers, those are the teachers who have kind of a not very formal training in special education, but have sort of a temporary license and are able to teach as kind of a path to their professional license, is the highest in special ed than any other category of teaching. So we have a lot of teachers that are well-meaning but might not have the training that they actually need to deal with kids like Sebastian and others. And I mean, these are not easy kids to deal with. These are students who can be seen and sometimes are dangerous, you know, who might pose an immediate threat to their fellow students or to faculty. But you know, in general, the reason they've arrived at that point is because they haven't been provided the services up till then, and they've become escalated and disassociated from things that could have redirected their behavior. So I would say that that's probably what's going on, broad strokes. But there are some districts that really have you know, had extraordinary numbers of students with disabilities referred to police. And obviously, Sebastian isn't a standalone case. There are a lot of kids like this across New Mexico.
This is kind of an example of the school to prison pipeline. In this case, it's based on disability. And it seems like such a huge waste of human potential. Sebastian, as you said, this very smart kid who could probably succeed beautifully with help. And yet the school is telling Sebastian's mother that he's a bad kid. They're calling the police. So that's a story. The second story that we're talking about today is titled False Alarms. And there you have a situation where parents are advocating for their children with special needs, and they're being retaliated against by the schools. It's not just that they're not being provided services, they're actually being punished for asking for the services to which they're entitled. Tell us that story.
This is a story that, you know, I first thought that I started hearing this when I was speaking to parents of special education students, and I thought at first, this can't be true. This has to be just an outlier, or maybe this parent doesn't, you know, is just so upset by what's been going on and their lack of progress in school that they're confused about what's going on. But then I heard from so many parents that this had happened, that CYFD had been called on them because they had fought with the administration over a special education services meeting at school, that they had filed a civil rights complaint, and then the police and CYFD came knocking right after that. It was, I mean, we heard from dozens of parents, maybe close to three dozen, that had this happen. And we spoke with CYFD as well. And one of the managers, Paul Williams, who manages the statewide central intake call center, that's the call center that screens reports of abuse made from the public for further investigation, he felt strongly that this was a very big problem, an ongoing problem, and a waste of CYFD resources. Unfortunately, this story is one, unlike the one about school arrests, that doesn't have much data behind it. CYFD doesn't have the infrastructure to really follow up and track calls that are made maliciously. Even though it is illegal, there's no repercussions for doing it because the infrastructure just doesn't exist to prosecute those calls unless it's, you know, somebody causes a lot of damage and CYFD decides to, you know, send a prosecutor out or something. I'm not aware of a case where that ever happened. And so, you know, it was more of an anecdotal lead, but one that was backed up by CYFD employees, and one that, you know, if you look back, right when CYFD opened this hotline, which is you dial #safe on your cell phone, and then you can file a report of abuse and neglect against somebody. Just months after they unveiled this program, the secretary of CYFD at the time, this is back in 2011, had a press conference about, please stop calling in malicious phone calls. You're wasting our time, and this is taking support and help away from a child who actually needs help. So it's been a problem from the beginning, but we don't really know the extent to the problem. And the fact that we don't know how often this is happening and there's no process for tracking these calls is allowing this to continue.
So tell us the story that you write about in the piece about Christy Cartwright. She's a mother of five in Carrizozo, New Mexico, and she's got kids with serious issues. And apparently the school is somebody, anonymous people, we don't know who, but people who are employees of that school are calling Children, Youth, and Families, CYFD, and making false claims about her, saying that that they're meth addicts or giving their children drugs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Christy Cartwright, yeah, is a mom of four. She's a mother of five, but she has four students who are in the public school system there in Carrizozo. And she has been fighting with the school district for many years over, you know, her kids' special education plans. There's not very many resources at that district. They don't even have their own special education staff. They rely on a cooperative in southern New Mexico, just like Ruidoso and a number of other districts do, and that are, you know, just don't have the size to really support a special ed team. But her kids, I believe all four of them, or at least three of them, have individualized education plans. That's the special education plan that schools are having to follow. And none of them have really been followed. This is a legal document, again, that's supposed to provide services. And in Christy's case, she is just at the end, as well as her husband, Harold, they're just at the end of their rope, and really kind of a toxic dynamic has developed between them and the school. A few examples of why they're so angry. Their oldest son, Marcus, has an IEP and is supposed to be getting a bunch of transitional services at the school as a special education student. He's got a lot of disabilities. He spends most of the time at school, in a storage room, playing video games or listening to music, and just, he says it's very lonely. He hears voices, and he says being secluded away from everyone else like that makes the voices stronger. At one point, the special education teacher drove Marcus up to the mountains. He has like a photography extracurricular, activity that he does as part of his IEP. So he likes to take pictures. He took him up to the mountains to take pictures and just let him wander loose. And he got lost up in the mountains, in the Sacramento mountains near Carrizozo for a number of hours. So the teacher didn't even follow him or keep track of him. And his parents were very angry with that. But, you know, what had made them especially angry was bullying that was going on. Almost all the kids, except for Marcus, they say were just consistently victims of bullies at school. Ashley, one of the daughters, would come home with spitballs in her hair, would come home, at one point was pushed to the ground by another student, according to the parents, and suffered a concussion. The school documentation of that just said she had a concussion after falling. You know, the kids' names were scrawled into the bathroom stalls with pejorative slurs. The principal and superintendent, there's one guy that serves as both principal and superintendent, wouldn't even recognize that the bullying was taking place. He was denying that there was any bullying at the school and wouldn't address it. So the parents were just fed up and were really a thorn in the side of the school. They thought they were harassing. The school thought the parents were just harassing them, which maybe they were, but they were harassing them about, failures of the special education system there. And they were demanding that they provide accommodations. Then we had a number of reports filed to CYFD immediately following an incident at the school where they kind of had a shouting match with the administration. At that same day, the principal and superintendent filed a harassment claim against Christy at the local police department. The police officer there, there's only two police officers, but the chief or captain or whatever his title is, told me that there's no grounds to pursue that. It's kind of an empty complaint. They're seeking a restraining order. But from that police document, we know that the CYFD reports were filed by a school employee and probably the superintendent, because the language is the same in both of them.
Right, right. It seems to be a situation where instead of doing what they're required to do by law, the schools are trying to get parents to withdraw their children from school, to just kind of make the problem go away, hope they'll put them in a private school or homeschool them. But in small rural communities, that's often not an option.
It's not an option. Homeschooling is an option, I guess. But, Christy Cartwright didn't have a GED. She couldn't do that. She couldn't move because her husband runs a home care business for Alzheimer's patients. You can't move Alzheimer's patients. So they're really stuck there, which is kind of why she says that they're not going to stop fighting with the district until they provide accommodations. So, it's hard to know what the motivations are. In the reports, they never say, here are our objectives in filing this false report. But according to some of the attorneys I've spoken with who have not prosecuted these cases, but, represented special education students and parents who this has happened to, just as a coincidence, it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction. They just are fed up. They want to get, they want to get rid of the parents. They want to get rid of the students that are so difficult. And Gail Stewart, who's an attorney in Albuquerque, who's really kind of the state's lead attorney on this, not for the state, but she has a private practice. But in New Mexico, she's probably prosecuted more special education cases than anyone. I mean, she really feels that this is a way to exclude children with disabilities from the public school system. That the bigger problem here is that schools just have a hesitation or a prejudice, as she would call it, against against children with disabilities. And it's easier just to just to get rid of them. And if this accomplishes that, then great. Of course, you know, to qualify that, there are so many wonderful special education teachers, wonderful schools who, you know, a lot of parents have had wonderful experiences, but a whole lot of them have had this happen to them. And it's very traumatizing. It can have very serious, you know, consequences for the students and the parents.
This is a situation where everybody loses and nobody wins. The schools are opening themselves up to continual hassle and liability by not being able to provide the services. They don't have the resources to provide the services in a lot of cases because of budgetary reasons. There's also doesn't seem to really be a culture that supports thinking well about this stuff. Meanwhile, Children, Youth, and Families is spending time and resources investigating claims that are false by people who are engaged in a ridiculous practice of retaliation.
Right. And sometimes it's very fault just on the surface. I mean, we've heard stories and seen, you know, documentation in many cases to back this up of, you know, a student saying she was hungry in class and so they got a CYFD complaint. You know, one time there was a dirty diaper, so there was a CYFD complaint. On, you know, CYFD says none of these things, you know, this could be evidence, but not in and of itself. There would have to be more. But even if CYFD at the call center decides this is baseless or we don't have any evidence to send an investigator out, they still have to cross-report that that call to the local police department and the local law enforcement. So no matter how frivolous on the face the call is, that family is still probably going to get a knock on the door from a police officer in uniform doing a wellness check. And you know, it really is intimidating for a mother or father to have the police come and say somebody's been accusing you at the school of abusing your kids, we need to come make sure they're okay. Not just because it's a shocking thing to happen, but the parents have a legal right to participate in the student's special education plan and program. When this happens, it really dampens that participation of the parents, which is really, at least according to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is really a crucial part of developing a successful special ed plan for the kids. So the kids' education suffers too, often because of these calls.
Like the story of Sebastian Montano, you're painting a picture of a situation where all trust is gone between families and the schools. And you need that trust if the school system is going to do its job serving the children. What's the next step? Like how are you seeing attempts at solutions to this seemingly intractable set of problems?
I mean, I think there's two parts of the answer. You know, the first part is that it's not like we don't have a process in place to address these issues, right? There is a federal law IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. There are state protocols in place. So on the surface, you could say, I think the solution is to follow the law, period. But I like I was saying earlier, I have a feeling that it's not that schools and teachers are intentionally not following the law or want to not follow the law. I think we have to ask, what is it that you need? What supports are you not getting in order, you know, to do what's supposed to be done according to IDEA and according to the Public Education Department standards? I think most teachers want to do a good job for their students. I think most teachers try their best, but why aren't they able to provide, you know, a behavior plan for students like Sebastian or an adequate special education program for students like Christy Cartwright's kids in Carrizozo or across the state where we're having similar issues, especially with bullying, which is kind of a whole nother can of worms. But I think we need to be asking ourselves and asking the teachers in a productive and constructive way, what do you need in order to follow the law?
I meant to ask you about that. What is the responsibility of the school to address bullying?
Well, there are, you know, I haven't done much research on this as of yet. There are requirements to report instances of bullying. I think there have been verified accusations of bullying, steps that have been taken, or, you know, and things like that to the federal government, to the Office of Civil Rights. in the Department of Education. You know, New Mexico is not doing very well in reporting that or any other data to the federal government. For example, in Carrizozo, where we have all these documented cases of bullying by the, you know, by other students against Christy Cartwright's kids, they've reported zero instances of bullying. So, you know, it's a self-reporting issue, and you run into the same problems with self-reporting as you do in many other industries. You know, like oil and gas is supposed to self-report their spills, and there's obviously incentive not to do that. And I think the same is true in schools. If you know, let on to the federal government and the Office of Civil Rights that you have a lot of bullying, that you have a lot of excessive discipline of kids with disabilities, they might look at you closely. So there are requirements in on that front. I don't know what every school's policy is, and I think it varies from school to school, just like, you know, the reporting requirements for calling in abuse and neglect vary from school to school. There's been no kind of uniform standards set out, so schools are kind of fending for themselves in a lot of ways. And I think that some schools have difficulties identifying, well, what is, how do you actually define a bullying instance? Sometimes it's clear, and sometimes it's not.
Some of the pieces that you've written for Searchlight New Mexico have led toward action to correct some very serious problems going on in our state. What are your hopes for addressing these sets of problems?
Gosh, well, you know, I guess first and foremost, I hope that Sebastian Montano and his mother are able to find some help from him. You know, at the end of the story, we mention how he was released from jail with an ankle monitor on the condition that he find a treatment program. He hasn't been able to find a treatment program because of his criminal record, so that's the catch-22 there. So I really hope that him and his mother are able to find some help, because they deserve it. You know, and the same goes for the Cartwright family. But you know, these aren't stories, like I say, of individual families. The reason these are important stories are because they represent a much larger problem that we haven't really taken necessary steps to address in the state. So I would hope that that we have a bigger conversation as a community and as a state about what are we gonna do with these children that have, you know, disabilities that we're not addressing properly. I mean, what is our responsibility to them, not just legally, but in terms of them being productive members of our community, and how do we go forward with that? I think there needs to be some pressure on elected leaders to address this issue, however that may be. But you know, these are issues that cut across. Anybody can have a kid with a disability, and many do, you know, and it's not an easy thing. Parents are already having an uphill battle with this in many ways, and they would tell you, we don't think the school and the education should be another uphill battle. So I think we just need to have some increased awareness and conversations around this going forward.
Ed Williams is an investigative reporter with Searchlight New Mexico. They are on the web at searchlightnm.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanel Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.